Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If your food media diet is fueled by HRN, become a monthly donor today. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Good afternoon. It's Monday, and that means it's time for What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we are going to be speaking with Emily Joyce, a fourth-year PhD student in the Department of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences, studying the reactive nitrogen cycle and the impacts that it has on coastal areas and the open ocean at Brown University. And with her is Professor Meredith Hastings, Deputy Director of the Institute at Brown for Environment and Society, as well as Professor of Environment and Society and Earth, Environmental and Planetary Sciences. So if that doesn't just make me just want to curl up in total shame that I have not accomplished anything like that in my lifetime, you know, good job, well done, young Meredith. Anyway, you guys, welcome back to your round two interview. For listeners, actually, Meredith and Emily were both my guests on my other radio iteration, which is a very local show here in Rhode Island. And I was moved to reach out to Emily because of an article that I read in a local publication here in Rhode Island called EcoRI News. And in that, in the publication, there was an article that referenced two papers that Meredith Hastings, the professor, has kind of overseen some of the research on. Emily, I think, has participated in writing both of them. The first of those papers is called Highly Concentrated Atmospheric Inorganic Nitrogen Deposition in an Herbal Coastal Region in the U.S. And in fact, that region turns out to be the upper Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island. And then the second iteration, or the second paper that caught my interest in this article, is called Sources of Ammonium in Seasonal Wet Deposition at a Coastal New England City, that being Providence. But for our purposes, we are going to kind of pull the lens out a little farther to talk about kind of what this means on a national and international level, because it is something that really does affect the air and water quality for all of us around the world. So let's start. Emily, you and your team studied the water quality in Upper Narragansett Bay for both of these studies. What exactly were you looking for when you decided to do these studies?
Thank you so much for the big introduction.
Sure.
Long titles. Yeah, thank you. So in Rhode Island, we have Narragansett Bay, which spans the whole state of Rhode Island. And so this is like one of, I think it's the largest estuary in New England. And so,
Doubt about that.
Yeah. Yep. So it's a huge water body. And what's interesting about it being in Providence is that it's also an urban area. So the Narragansett Bay as a whole has suffered from water quality historically for many years. But there's been a lot of regulations put in place, such as a reduction of nutrients coming in from different sources. So we focus on nitrogen in our group. Mm-hmm. And so a big reduction that's been put in place for Narragansett Bay is there's been a 60% reduction in wastewater treatment nitrogen coming in.
Right.
So that's been
huge.
So in
other words, stormwater, they've managed to figure out a way to treat wastewater better or manage stormwater runoff better. Is that fair to say? Yes, both. Okay.
Yeah, very fair. Yeah, so that's been a 60% reduction. And so the bay has improved tremendously from those reductions.
Right.
So we're seeing like seagrasses come back in different locations in the upper bay for the first time in 30 years and beaches open, fish being able to be harvested further north. So that is great, but there's still days of poor water quality. And what was interesting is that there's recent work coming out of the University of Rhode Island that says that, or that showed that water quality, poor water quality events tend to occur after large precipitation events,
which we see more and more of as the climate shifts.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Warms. Yes,
exactly. So that was really interesting to us to think about, like, what would be in the rain that could be causing this. And so to think about that, there's a lot of monitoring that's going on across the country. So there's a program called the National Atmospheric Deposition Program. They monitor precipitation weekly across the country, all states except for Rhode Island, I believe. There's there isn't a site in Rhode Island.
We almost have to be a little bit different here in the Rhodey.
Exactly.
Can't do what everybody else does.
But all those, or the majority of these monitoring sites tend to be in rural areas because they want to get the well-mixed background. So they don't want to be biased next to like a highway, for instance, and then they're really just capturing what's in the rain from highway emissions. So they're all in rural areas. So to think about the rain for an urban area like Providence, it's not so helpful. So we were really interested in looking at the rain in Providence and urban coastal environment, especially because those regulations that I said, there's been nothing done for the nitrogen that's gone in from the atmosphere for the last 30 years. Or by nothing done, I mean it hasn't been monitored.
Right.
So we continue to change the values of nitrogen going in from different sources like wastewater, as I keep saying, but we have the same exact value that we're saying is going in to the bay from the atmosphere for the last 30 years.
And of course, that is not by any stretch an accurate measurement.
Yeah. So as an atmospheric group, we know that's not accurate. In some ways, it's there's been improvements like from the Clean Air Act. So it's not even that we just were trying to be negative with like, it's so much worse. But it's definitely different than it was 30 years ago.
Interesting. So were you surprised by the results that you discovered? What exactly were you looking for? Like, where was the nitrogen coming from? Or were you looking for other types of atmospheric pollution that would be precipitated into the water and onto the land through rainfall? Let's start with what you were looking for and then whether or not you were surprised by what you found.
Yeah. So the first thing we were just wondering is just how much nitrogen is in the rain and in what forms. So we have nitrogen that comes in from the atmosphere there's organic nitrogen and then there's inorganic nitrogen. So we're really interested in the inorganic components because those are like nitrate and ammonium. And those are what you'd find in fertilizer. So just like you fertilize your lawn, if you fertilize the water, it's going to cause the phytoplankton in the water, the biology, to take that nitrogen up, and it's going to change what's going on in the water.
And that's what causes eutrophication, or what we now know as the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, is a primary example of that phenomenon, right?
Yes, exactly. So we were wondering just how much that has changed. And the reason also that we were interested in those two nutrients is that's what's in our policy right now for the bay is the numbers that they're using are from those organic nitrogen, nitrate, and ammonium from 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so in doing that, we were surprised to see that the concentration of ammonium has gone up tremendously. So it's gone up 6 times.
Yikes.
So nitrate has actually gone down, which is great. So that's gone down because of different regulations like the Clean Air Act, which regulates nitrogen oxide emissions, which leads to nitrate deposition. So so that is good. And we're seeing that across the whole country. It's not something that's unique about Providence.
Right.
So nitrate has gone down. And we saw that in our precipitation here. So that is well representative. But ammonium, we weren't expecting it to be so high. And that's really important because ammonium is actually the most biologically available form of nitrogen. So that means that if the species have their choice of ammonium or nitrate, they're going to take ammonium up first because it requires less energy to use that nitrogen.
So in fact, it will accelerate, say, the development of, phytoplankton or now would this be implicated in what they call cyanobacteria or blue-green algae, which is toxic? Would this also be implicated in that in those blooms that we see, say, for example, in Lake Erie every year has a big bloom of what they call blue-green algae, which I think is the scientific name is cyanobacteria.
Yeah, that is what it's called, yeah.
So when you see big blooms of that, is that because there's a lot of ammonia, because it's so readily taken up by these organisms, that the ammonium is actually contributing more than one would expect to those kinds of phenomena?
It can. They're nitrogen fixers. So it doesn't have to be, but yeah, it can be taken.
So what are the, just to be clear, what are the primary sources for the nitrogen and ammonia deposits you identified?
So one of the interesting things about Emily's study was that one of the interesting things about Emily's study was that we really see this rural to urban gradient. So we see much higher concentrations in the urban rain than we do in these monitoring stations that are located in more well-mixed background areas. Uh-huh. And so that implicates that, it's likely that there are some local sources also contributing. Because otherwise, why wouldn't it just represent the background that, everybody is seeing in the region, right? Like, right. For example, in Connecticut and Massachusetts, et cetera.
And so, part of the sources for this, let's be clear, is from fossil fuel. From burning gas in transportation, presumably fuel oil in your heating, in your furnace, things like that?
Yeah, so we usually think of that as definitely being an important source of nitrogen oxides, which leads to nitrate deposition.
Okay.
For ammonia, there are industrial sources. Fossil fuel combustion alone isn't usually an ammonia source unless there's nitrogen contained in the fuels. Oh. But what's happening now with catalytic converters is that in order to make them, just as efficient or more efficient and to burn oil in your engine, right, to keep your car going efficiently, but also to reduce emissions based on the Clean Air Act, is they've modified catalytic converters to try to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions. And so what happens usually for NOx is that you basically heat up the air and you split N2 and O2. And then they recombine and form. So you split nitrogen and oxygen, they recombine and form NO. But in the case of these new catalytic converters, they're actually over-reducing the nitrogen, so you get ammonia emissions instead of NOx emissions. Or, you get more ammonia emissions relative to NOx emissions than you used to. So vehicles are becoming a more and more important source of ammonia, and that's true across the country. So we're seeing ammonia increase, but we also still have a lot of questions about, what's happening in these urban areas, because we usually think of agriculture as being the primary source of ammonia and ammonium.
Yes.
But now we're seeing ammonia and ammonium in urban areas in high concentration. So there's clearly urban sources of ammonia as well. And we have diagnosed that vehicles are an important source. And we've worked on a study actually in Providence as well, that we see that vehicles are an important source seasonally. But it's interesting to think about, especially in urban areas, the combination of if you are, downwind of an agricultural region, plus you have local sources, then, ammonia is not just a problem for agricultural regions. It's actually becoming a problem for urban regions as well.
Right, right. We're going to dig into that, because now that we've sort of identified where the various these various components come from, I want to get to what role agriculture does play in the findings that you had. And to be even more specific than that, I hope I'm not being too simplistic, but I'm going to assume that, for example, concentrated animal feeding operations, also known as CAFOs, where you have gigantic either mounds of, litter from chicken houses or manure lagoons from hog houses. I know that they're giving off ammonia. Would that be part of the ammonium, or is that only caused by nitrogen and sort of the application of fertilizers and so forth?
No, that doesn't cause it. Any way that you can volatilize ammonia, it will convert to ammonium readily.
Okay.
Lifetime of ammonia is actually pretty, relatively short. So, yeah. The application of fertilizer, you lose some of the ammonium that into the gas phase, which is ammonia.
Right.
And that's the same for fertilizer. That's the same for manure. Any source of high ammonium is going to probably volatilize into ammonia into the atmosphere.
Right.
And then it can be transported and then gets converted back to ammonium. And in our case, with this study, we were looking at rainwater. So right. We're looking at everything that gets, you know, washed out of the air.
Right. So talk a little bit about how you were able to identify, because I thought this was fascinating, how you were able to identify agricultural culprits when you were studying the movement of these gases across the country. Like, so how can you tell whether it's from a car or from a cow?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, it's an excellent question. And so there's a couple answers to that. One is that what we're measuring, right, is a particular concentration in rain on a particular day in Rhode Island. But then we're combining that with a couple of other tools to help us understand where that concentration comes from. So one is looking at transport. So we can actually, based on meteorological data, so wherever there's weather stations, you can actually back calculate where the air came from. So basically, okay, I know there's a, you know, a storm this afternoon. Where yep. did that air come from before it reached here? And we will back calculate that for several days based on the lifetime of these gases. So that we can say, okay, well, you know, the gases and particles that are being transported in and then washed out with the rain, you know, where could they have come from? So we know, for example, that the, you know, transport in one case, you know, is, you know, from the Midwest of the United States or Midwest Canada, and that was, you know, where these storms were coming from. So we know that air has transported. The other tool that we've been using in my group and most of my research is dedicated to using isotopic tracers. Okay. So these are stable isotopes. They're the same element. So in our case, we're looking at nitrogen. So it's the same element with slightly different masses, and it's naturally occurring. And when I say stable, it's because it's not radioactive. So there's both what we call nitrogen. There's both nitrogen-14 and nitrogen. Yeah, right, exactly. No nuclear science here. But there's...
Sorry.
So the nitrogen in the environment is in two forms, what we call N14 and N15. So they have slightly different masses. So N15 weighs slightly more than N14.
Okay.
And there's only a tiny bit amount of N15. There's like 99% of the nitrogen in our environment is N14, and there's this tiny percent of N15. So because of that, different physical and biological processes will treat N15 and N14 differently, and we can quantify that. And so we found that different sources actually have different signatures associated with them. And so you can almost think of these like isotopes as like different sizes or shapes or colors. So they travel around in the environment slightly in different ways, but we can track that and quantify it. And so we were able to also look at the isotopic composition of the ammonium in the rainwater and diagnose, you know, when it was from, like, particularly from the marine environment, you know, or from the agricultural environment, or from the urban environment. And combining that with the transport, right, we were able to better diagnose kind of which sources would be most important. And in the case of rainwater, we have to consider the transport piece, you know, importantly, because, you know, when you think sure. about where the clouds are above our heads, when it rains, it's washing out everything in the cloud and everything below it. So it is contained. It does contain pollution that's been transported along with those air masses. You know, there's other things we can do, like when we look at just particulate matter, oftentimes that's a combination of stuff that's been transported as well as local sources because, you know, and so if you're collecting, like if you're sucking air, like a lot of times with the methods we use, we'll like suck air through a filter and yeah. filter out the actual particles that are in the air. And then we can study the chemical composition of those. But those particles, especially close to the ground, you know, close to where we're breathing, are often, you know, associated with local sources compared to what's, you know, from the cloud all the way to the ground that's going to be associated with both transport and local pollution.
Right, right. So we're going to have to take a quick break, which for your purposes, I mean really quick, for a sponsor drop. And we'll be right back with Dr. Professor Meredith Hastings and PhD candidate Emily Joyce to talk more about the movement of these polluting gases through our atmosphere and into our water supply. So stay tuned.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. You may have noticed that we have a whole new look. We also launched a new website that's going to make your listening easier and more enjoyable than ever before. HRN is the original food podcast network. And as we enter a new chapter in our 12-year history, I want to ask you to invest in HRN for the long haul. If you rely on this show to fuel your food media diet, become a monthly sustaining member today. Our members keep the voice of America's food movement alive and kicking. Your donations support this podcast along with 40 other shows on Heritage Radio Network. Your contribution helps give HRN the security we need to stay on the airwaves throughout the pandemic, and your continued support is allowing us to reopen our studio. Plus, we like to give our regular members special treatment. So sign up to become a monthly donor and get access to our secret menu. We've gathered together exclusive discounts and offers from some of your favorite food and beverage brands. So you get to enjoy insider pricing on goods that will ship right to your door. Join our community of monthly donors, and special deals will come your way throughout the summer. So can you make a gift of $5 or $10 a month? It'll show me and our whole team at HRN how much this podcast and food radio in general means to you. Become a monthly sustaining member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Okay, so we're back. So you were just saying that it is actually possible to differentiate between the ammonium that is produced as a result of, say, fertilizer applications, as opposed to the ammonium that emanates from animal waste, for example, in concentrated animal feeding operations. But you were also saying that some of these gases are coming from very long distances, and you were referring to particulate matter, which is another thing that I know travels on the wind, and that is not in any way poetic when you think about what it actually is.
Right. So
can you talk a little bit about sort of the distances and also what is in, you know, what is particulate matter? Why should people be even thinking about this? I mean, does this matter for, you know, the average layman, or is it, you know, I mean, is it something we should all be aware of, more aware of, or is it something that really is kind of just the purview of science, of scientists like yourselves?
I think we should all care a lot about it.
Okay, so
it really affects our air quality. Particulate matter, you can actually like suck into your lungs directly.
Yes.
And so the EPA monitors particulate matter. So we also call particulate matter aerosols. So aerosols are literally any, they're suspended particles, droplets, you know, in the air. So when you have a hazy day, you know, for those of you in the Northeast or on the West Coast, last week we had some hazy days associated with the fires that were happening in the West. But sure. Because of the way that the air was traveling, we actually received some of that air here with particulate matter. And so when you get those hazy days or smoggy days in the summertime, especially, you know, wildfire smoke is a source. Desert dust is a smoke. Sea salt is a you know, ash, soot, wood burning. All of those are sources of particulate matter.
And can I stop you for a second?
Yeah,
Is that more so in the summer? And if so, why?
So particulate matter is around all year. And actually, I would say our concentrations are probably higher in the winter than in the summertime.
Oh, right.
Whereas when we think about ozone, which is part of smog, ozone is produced much more readily in the summer than in the winter. So
because of the heat.
Yeah. So temperature is has a direct effect on that. Sunlight does too, right? We have more sunlight in the summer as well. So, so the particulate matter, it depends on your sources, like which season it would be, you know, important. But you know, here we do a lot more burning, like of wood, for example, and coal and things like that in the wintertime. And so that tends to increase our particulate matter concentrations in the winter relative to summer. Go ahead.
I was going to say that, you know, I'm thinking about like when, for example, London, which was famous for its fog back in the 19th century, in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, or as the Industrial Revolution really ramped up. And that was entirely due to the coal that was being burned in every single home.
It was the coal and the weather.
And the weather, right.
So if anybody's seen the Netflix show, there was a
The Midwife?
No, the, Oh my God, it's on the tip of my tongue. The Queen.
Oh, yes, sure.
Queen's Gambit?
No, the one.
No, so, the Crown.
The Crown. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, The Crown had this awesome like dramatization of that time period, right? Because it part of the show takes place in that time period in London when they have these really severe acidic fogs. And so what was happening there, and the meteorologists did warn them, right, that they were going to have these very stagnant air, very low, what we call boundary layer. So like basically, you know, it's like the air settles down into towards the ground and it doesn't move. And mm-hmm. so they had these really heavy fogs near the surface that were sort of stuck there, and they were burning coal, you know, in the city. And so one of the big things that transitioned after that time period was that they moved a lot of the coal burning outside the city. So that we would, and then they also increased the stack heights. So if you increase the stack height, then the winds above our heads are blowing much faster than they are near the ground. And so you're blowing away a lot of that material. So that's actually why, like, you know, sometimes people refer to the Northeast as, and like Rhode Island in particular often will use the phrase that like we're the end of the tailpipe. And that's because a lot of emissions from coal and agriculture are happening in the Midwest, but those are being transported towards, you know, towards us in, you know, on the, in the Northeast. And so, you know, that is an issue for our air quality, right? That we are bringing in a lot of pollution from outside of our city, but it is affecting our air quality.
Our air quality and our water quality as well, as you have determined. So I've read that particulate matter can travel literally thousands of miles across oceans and, you know, deposit those compounds on other continents. So let me ask you this. Why does some stuff get rained out closer to home and some of it travel those long, long distances? Like, you know, what some stuff is heavier than other stuff? Or it depends on weather events. Part was kind of murky to me.
Yeah, that's a good point that you made. So some parts of it does matter with the mass, because like particles are heavier, so they could settle out faster than gases in the air. So gases will be blown further because of their mass. But also the species that we looked at in this program have, or in this program, in this project, have short lifetimes. So lifetimes are really important, and their solubility. So their solubility is what makes their lifetime. So you can think about like ammonium. It can be a lifetime as short as a half hour. And so it's not going to get very far then for a gas. The particle might go farther. So everything has its own lifetime.
Right.
And the species that we focused on have short lifetimes. There's other species that will make it across the ocean every day because they have longer lifetimes.
What would be an example of something like that?
I mean, we see particulate matter in the United States from China. So there's a lot of techniques you can use to look at the chemical composition of the particles and actually know where they originated from. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, what are they? What are those compounds that you're seeing from China, for example? Is it soil particles? Is it waste from feeding operations? I mean, you can see I have a bit of a hobby horse here with the
right. So it's
with the CAFOs, but like that really is a thing. Like when I was researching the book I wrote about the meat industry, like that just flipped me out to realize that these particles that could often include antibiotic resistant bacteria were traveling literally thousands of miles and depositing on, you know, some poor, unfortunate continent. Like, or countries, say in Africa, where, you know, they don't have CAFOs, you know, like,
right.
And they're not overusing antibiotics. And it seems kind of unfair to me, you know, like stuff like that. So, you know, or getting into the water table or being taken up by plants, you know, all of that stuff scared the bejesus out of me. So that's why I'm sort of drilling down on this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the whole atmosphere exchanges in about a year time scale, like the entire atmosphere. So I often, I teach a weather and climate course at Brown University, and I often will show the students pictures of satellite observations of particulate matter concentration in the atmosphere after the Mount Pinatubo explosion. So Mount Pinatubo's in the Philippines, in the Pacific Ocean. And like you could see an effect through the entire tropics, so like between, you know, 20 north and 20 south of the entire world within 2 months. Because that material just moves very, very quickly around the tropics. And then you could see it through the entire world within 4 months. So depending on, so if the lifetime of your material that you're looking at, if the lifetime is longer than, you know, a year, then it's going to be well mixed in the atmosphere. Like it can reach anywhere. So mm-hmm. we see, you know, so we see deposits of things like black carbon in Greenland and Antarctica, right? There's no right. industry in Greenland. There's, right. so, you know, those materials are coming from, you know, the Europe and the United States and, to Greenland, to Antarctica, right? It's the Southern Hemisphere. So certainly like bacteria can be transported on the surface of particles, all kinds of material. So in your response in terms of what we see from China, I mean, we do see a lot of soil material and crustal material. And we see that from Africa too. Like, if the wind, like particularly during the summer, right, with these, with the hurricane season, uh-huh. you get a lot of winds off of the coast of Africa into the North Atlantic Ocean. And actually dust is an important source of like nutrients to the ocean as well. And always has been, right? Even before there were, you know, our imprint on top of the dust.
Right. And of course now we have these epic drought periods.
Yes.
Which are having such an impact on African agriculture that it will soon be very hard for them to grow anything, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's move on for a second though. So let's talk a little bit about regulations. Because to my knowledge, there are few, if any, regulations on agricultural emissions. And I know you guys answered this the other day, but I still feel like this is an important question. Is there a method with which one can accurately identify and measure those emissions in order for legislators to form some kind of a regulatory framework? In other words, would it be possible for, say, the government to... Because let me backtrack for a second. Right now, everybody's talking about cap and trade and carbon credits and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And yet, first of all, nobody really understands what the threshold should be. And I'm wondering if scientists have even figured out how to accurately measure those emissions, no matter where they're from, in order to formulate a threshold to which they can then hold an industry accountable for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I would say, I mean, one thing to recognize, right, is that the scientists don't set the standards, right? The regulatory process does.
Fair enough.
So that, you know, that has its own, you know, issues attached to it. One issue being that when you look at the criteria pollutants that the EPA monitors now, if you read in any textbook, like there's no safe level of ozone. But regulators and industry citizen groups have come together to decide that, like, here's a level that we're going to say, you know, this is the level at which we should not exceed. And, you know, and if we exceed this level, then we have to do something about our air quality or you're going to pay fines and, you know, you have to clean up the air. So there's an agreement upon which those levels are reached, which is not always based purely on the science. So I just want to say that, you know, it's a complicated process. Now, ammonia, which is agriculture, is by far the biggest source of on the planet, is not regulated in the United States at all. So,
but it is regulated in other countries?
Somewhat, yes.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not yet regulated at all in Europe either. And so I think that, you know, like this is becoming the new nitrogen we need to worry about. It okay. used to be nitrate because nitrate is nitric acid and that's part of our acid rain. And before that it was sulfate because sulfate is sulfuric acid. And that was like in the 80s, our major acid rain problem was
right.
sulfate. We cleaned up the sulfate. You know, now we've cleaned up the NOx. We've gotten the emissions, you know, down much lower, but we haven't done anything about ammonia yet. So there is success stories there. And there's a whole framework in place that if we started regulating ammonia, there would be ways to, you know, to set up, you know, monitoring and be able to evaluate those levels. But that hasn't been done yet. I do understand and totally agree with, you know, your impression that there's a lot of resistance on the part of industrial agriculture to really modify what they're doing. However, I think that, you know, we are, you know, at these different junctures where we have to better understand, you know, how to reduce that pollution and the implications for our air quality. And that's both from the standpoint of, you know, if you're not using cover crops, right, then the dust of the, and there's drought, then
sure.
these huge farmlands are also serving as a component of dust. If
yep.
you, you know, are applying way too much fertilizer, then a lot of it is being run off into our waterways and a lot of it's being released into the air and then affecting, you know, places much further downwind than locally. So so there is a need to be thinking and strategizing more on that front. And I think a lot of emphasis has been put on, in the recent past, have been put on greenhouse gases and like farms being a source of greenhouse gases. But, mm-hmm. you know, the air quality, I think, might be a more salient issue for people and one that they can kind of wrap their heads around a little bit more readily because it is, you know, it affects your everyday breathing.
Right.
And, you know, the rates of asthma are going up everywhere and particularly in regions that are also downwind of agriculture, not just in cities. And that's because right. of this, you know, phenomena of the way that these chemical, these gases are being emitted and then forming these particles that, you know, can then be taken
And these,
in.
And for example, the rates of asthma increasing, you feel fairly confident that you could ascribe that to these higher levels of ammonium, for example, in the atmosphere?
Not just ammonia, no. But, and that's like, that's one of the things that, you know, we hope that these isotopic tools can help contribute to is really being sure. able to distinguish what are the sources and therefore, you know, where should we be focusing our energy on in terms of regulation and monitoring. So I don't think that link has been directly made, but I do, I mean, it is starting to be made for wildfires, right? We are definitely seeing wildfire material in urban areas that are increasing, you know, the rates of asthma and increasing the rates of respiratory,
sure.
you know, distress.
I think the case for
agriculture is a little bit more challenging at this point. But I agree that, you know, there does need to be more likely done in the near future to be thinking about, you know, how to better regulate ammonia emissions.
So, you know, when we talk about, you know, you guys, you're in your silo, you're doing your research. You are obviously not alone. I'm sure there is a vast global network of scientists, much like yourselves in every nation, doing similar work. And you probably all get together periodically at symposiums and compare your papers and your findings. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? Is there a mechanism by which you can, transfer this knowledge to legislators or people in, or, you know, like, I guess the EPA or, you know, I'm just like, I'm thinking, for instance, about the current, you know, the pandemic that won't quit. Mm-hmm. And we have these morons like DeSantis and Abbott and, you know, the rest of these fools who have decided that they somehow know better than the CDC. And, you know, meanwhile, this disease is scouring through the population. You know, like, I don't understand how these men can justify and women, I should say, justify their positions as legislators. And I just can only assume that they are grossly uneducated and somehow have decided that they don't need to be informed. And so that's what makes me fear that the kind of great work that you and your cohort are doing will kind of never see the light of day from the point of view of public health standpoint or an environmental standpoint, just because we got a bunch of yahoos running the show who are more interested in profit over people. And that, you know, that's just been the capitalist mantra for these many 40, 50 years now. But the whole thing is, you know, profit over people and be damned to the consequences. So I fear, you know, like I'm just wondering how you feel, you know, as scientists, like you put all this energy and effort and money and, you know, education into this work. And then where does it go for you? Like what happens?
The way that you describe our process is pretty right on, right? Like we do a lot of this work over the course of years and you know, when a paper like Emily's gets published, I mean, it's been through the peer review process. So the paper goes to the journal, the editor reviews it, then the editor sends it out to experts in the area. They review it, they return comments. We have to respond to those comments. And, you know, ultimately, if everyone is satisfied and the work is solid, then it gets published. And so by the time it's actually published, right, it's already been through, like, it's already been vetted a fair amount. That is for journals that, you know, participate in the review process, right? So sure. It doesn't go just to publication. So, so by the time that, you know, that kind of information is making its way into a regulatory framework or making its way onto, you know, the into the popular press's hands, you know, it's been readily reviewed. And so I think that the challenge now in our society is to really try to get everyone to take a step back and take a deep breath and think about what do you want, you know, what do you want your quality of life to look like? And, you know, the reduction of pollution in the United States is huge, a huge success story overall, but we still have work to do, right? We still have plenty of unhealthy areas. Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of disparity in where those unhealthy areas occur. And we need, you know, we need to do a lot of work on this, and we need to participate in a evidence-based system and not a belief system. So a lot of the politicians you're talking about, you know, and a lot of the news media now, it's all about, you know, politicizing our understanding of, you know, of the science and choosing a belief system rather than asking, well, what evidence do you have that suggests mm-hmm. I should follow a different path? And so if you can show me evidence that, you know, going unvaccinated and unmasked is neither a detriment to you nor anyone in your life that you've come into contact with, then I will happily concede that maybe masks aren't a problem. But instead, we have overwhelming evidence to the contrary, right? Overwhelming evidence that being vaccinated, that wearing a mask is helpful, that, you know, the community spread is way less under those circumstances. And so, you know, I think, again, people are kind of listening to a political ideology. We saw the same thing happen with, you know, climate change in this country as well. And it's not true in every country. And so, you know, in our country, you know, especially under the current administration, the way that the EPA functions is to bring together scientists who review the literature and to see, you know, what are the latest measurements that are out there? What is the data telling us? What is the long-term data telling us?
Right.
You know, which data has been vetted and really is accurate and repeatable, and which data has not been repeated, so that they can make the best decisions possible based on the information we have at hand. And that's a requirement of the Clean Air Act, is that they have to, and the Clean Water Act, like they come under review every, I forget exactly the timeline, maybe like 6 years or 8 years or something like that. So it goes under review, and then they bring in, you know, EPA scientists as well as, you know, academic scientists as well as industrial scientists to come in and review the criteria pollutants and see, you know, what is our latest information? Is there any need to change, you know, the levels at which we are monitoring and the levels at which we say, you know, this is safe, right? Or this is, you know, mm-hmm. okay air quality and or okay water quality. So those are periodically reviewed, and it's an important process, and it's an important process to have scientists involved in, right? It's not a political process. It is not a process by which it should be, you know, word of mouth, right? It really has to be
it's
something.
It's not for me to say, oh, well, I see it's a hazy day. I think we need to like start monitoring some air quality around here. You know what I mean? But as you guys pointed out at the top of the show, you know, Emily made this point, which was that the nitrates had been reduced over the course of 30 years, but the level at which ammonium had been, or I should say the safe levels at which ammonium had been set had not been reviewed in some 30 years. And the purpose of your paper, as I understood it, was to take a second look at what actually is a safe or, you know, appropriate level of ammonium in the atmosphere to kind of combat some of these water quality issues that you were looking at. Isn't that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say.
So in other words, I guess my point there, and then we have to wrap this up, but my point is that the more frequent, given the speed at which, you know, industry changes and the speed at which the climate is changing at this point, it seems to me that we need to be reviewing these standards, like, you know, maybe on a yearly or bi-yearly basis. Would that ever be possible, or is there just never going to be enough research money out there to do that?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely that we would do it on an every year process. I mean, but I think the consideration of new pollutants, right, is something that we probably, I mean, because, you know, the stuff we're talking about today, you know, are things that affect air quality and water quality directly, but they're also not things that we consider like you know, air toxics that are cancer causing,
right.
Or have instantaneous detrimental, you know, impact on your body.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a whole host of things, right, that need to be, to me, looked at regularly, and how pollution is being transported, and, you know, what pollution is coming where, so that we can better understand how to regulate it. And, you know, we're spending a lot of money, you know, regulating something locally, you know, but it's all coming from somewhere else. And, you know, maybe we should be investing that money, you know, to try to help, you know, upwind, you know, change their,
right.
you know, their emissions, or, you know, or yeah, or investing in farms in a way that, you know, I mean, I think the pro side of the farming system is that it's highly managed. And so if we can figure out ways that we can get similar crop yields, but really markedly improve pollution rates, right? Who isn't going to want to do that?
Sure. Absolutely.
So, but the trick is, right, is figuring out and working together with, like, at the level of industrial agriculture of, you know, how can we really improve things? You know, how can we take manure, turn it into fertilizer that's still useful, but is, you know, decreases the amount of manure that you have to just pile up on your, you know, farm, where it's just, you know, washing off into waterways and
right, or emitting methane and all the rest of it. Yes. Absolutely. Well, ladies, I'm gonna drop it here. I can't thank you enough for this. I mean, I really have learned so much from both of you on both of our forays into the airwaves here. I hope you'll stay in touch and let me know if you're, you know, if there's something else that is that you think would be of interest to me. I'm always, like, you know, Thursday and Monday roll around every week, just in case you didn't know that. I'm always looking for guests. So, and I love having smart, you know, intelligent, well-informed, educated people on the show, you know. Just saying, because then it makes me look good, because, of course, I'm none of those things. Well, smart enough, but certainly not well-educated. So it's really all about me, ladies. I don't know. You know. Sorry.
Well, thanks so much for your interest, and we appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, thank you, and good luck with all the rest of the work. And, yeah, let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you to my wonderful engineer, Amanda, and, of course, to our sponsors. We'll see you next week. Have a good one. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.